Our gospel reading for the morning comes from the Gospel of John. We'll be starting in, make sure I get this right, chapter 11 with verses 1 through 6 and then skipping ahead to 17 through 45. I encourage you to take advantage of the pew Bibles in front of you for two very simple reasons. The first is that if I make a mistake, you won't be fooled. And the second is that it's a very long reading, and we all lost an hour of sleep. And it is much easier to stay focused when you have the text right in front of you to read along. So I encourage you to turn to page 979. You're reading starting at chapter 11. Now a certain man was ill, Lazarus of Bethany, the village of Mary and her sister Martha. Mary was the one who anointed the Lord with perfume and wiped his feet with her hair. Her brother Lazarus was ill, so the sisters sent a message to Jesus, "Lord, he whom you love is ill." But when Jesus heard it, he said, "This illness does not lead to death. Rather, it is for God's glory, so that the Son of Man may be glorified through it." Accordingly, though Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus, after having heard that Lazarus was ill, he stayed 2 days longer in the place where he was. And then skipping ahead to verse 17. When Jesus arrived, he found that Lazarus had already been in the tomb 4 days. Now Bethany was near Jerusalem, some 2 miles away, and many of the Jews had come to Martha and Mary to console them about their brother. When Martha heard that Jesus was coming, she went and met him, while Mary stayed at home. Martha said to Jesus, "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. But even now I know that God will give you whatever you ask of him." Jesus said to her, "Your brother will rise again." Martha said to him, "I know that he will rise again in the resurrection on the last day." And Jesus said to her, "I am the resurrection and the life. Those who believe in me, even though they die, will live. And everyone who lives and believes in me will never die. Do you believe this?" She said, "Yes, Lord, I believe that you are the Messiah, the Son of God, the one coming into the world." When she had said this, she went back and called her sister Mary and told her privately, "The teacher is here and is calling for you." And when she heard it, she got up quickly and went to him. Now Jesus had not yet come to the village, but was still at the place where Martha had met him. The Jews who were with her in the house consoling her saw Mary get up quickly and go out. They followed her because they thought that she was going to the tomb to weep there. When Mary came where Jesus was and saw him, she knelt at his feet and said to him, "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died." When Jesus saw her weeping, and the Jews who came with her also weeping, he was greatly disturbed in spirit and deeply moved. He said, "Where have you laid him?" They said to him, "Lord, come and see." Jesus began to weep. So the Jews said, "See how he loved him?" But some of them said, "Could not he who opened the eyes of the blind, opened the eyes of the blind man, have kept this man from dying?" Then Jesus said, again, greatly disturbed. Then Jesus, again greatly disturbed, came to the tomb. It was a cave, and a stone was lying against it. Jesus said, "Take away the stone." Martha, the sister of the dead man, said to him, "Lord, already there is a stench, because he has been dead 4 days." Jesus said to her, "Did I not tell you that if you believed, you would see the glory of God?" So they took away the stone. And Jesus looked upward and said, "Father, I thank you for having heard me. I knew that you always hear me, but I have said this for the sake of the crowd standing here, so that they may believe that you sent me." When he had said this, he cried out with a loud voice, "Lazarus, come out!" The dead man came out, his hands and feet bound with strips of cloth, and his face wrapped in a cloth. Jesus said, "Unbind him and let him go." Many of the Jews, therefore, who had come with Mary and had seen what Jesus did, believed in him. This ends the reading. Lent is a great time to talk about death. We're walking week by week closer to the story of Jesus' death and resurrection. Many of us have been struggling throughout Lent to give something up, which is a small kind of death, a death to self. It's good that Lent only comes once a year, because death is hard to talk about. It's also good that Lent comes at least once a year, whether we like it or not, because death is important to talk about. We live in a culture that minimizes death and idolizes youth. Death to self? We'd much rather talk about self-help, self-actualization, self-esteem, self-awareness. We'd much rather talk about anything than self-denial. We distract ourselves from the world's suffering with fancy toys. We distract ourselves from our own brokenness with frenetic activity. We need to stop at least once a year. Try and see things as they really are. We have a church without martyrs, a world without justice, and wars without ends. These are easy to get excited about. Obvious. Preachers stand up and say, "It's a sin and a shame. We sit here in luxury and other people starve." And everyone nods their head and agrees that it's a horrible sin and a horrible shame, a tragedy. And we should all feel rotten for being born in America and enjoying the privilege of being an American. And that's the goal, right? Make people feel rotten. Everyone feels guilty. If everyone feels guilty, they'll want to be forgiven. They'll seek out a priest. That's the trap of religion. Religions set themselves up as mediators between God and humanity. They claim a monopoly on forgiveness. So it's in their best interest to make you feel guilty. That's what keeps you coming back. You feel good while you're here, and then you walk out the door, and it's not 5 minutes. But you've done something wrong, and you're back to square one, and then through the course of the week, these negative guilt feelings and shame just keep piling up until finally Sunday morning you get to go back to church and feel good about yourself again. That's the easy way. You just make people feel vaguely guilty and offer vague forgiveness and send them on their way. Or you could go with the even easier way. Make them feel really, really guilty once and offer them forgiveness forever. Just pray the prayer written on the back of this tract, and you'll go to heaven. If you've ever committed the tiniest of sins, stretched the truth even a little bit, had a sexual thought about someone who is not currently your spouse, if you've ever failed to do good when it was in your power to do good, then you are a sinner, worthy of the flames of hell. Better pray that prayer quick. You might die right now. Sitting in that pew right now, you might die. And then what would happen? Better pray that prayer. All you have to do is pray. See how easy it is? But there's still a catch. What if you don't pray it well enough? What if you pray it, then you forget? What if you pray and you really, really mean it? And then you change your mind. Do you have to pray again? Once you get your get out of hell free card, is it possible to lose it? Uh-oh. I better go to church. It's the religion trap all over again. Only I don't have to make you feel guilty every week. You feel guilty just fine all by yourself. But I'm not here to make you feel guilty. I'm not here to offer forgiveness. Forgiveness is already offered without limit, without price tag. I'm in no position to barter between you and God. God has come to earth and eliminated the middleman. I'm here to say that this is the place where it's okay to tell the truth about what's going on in the world, about what's going on in our lives. So let's tell the truth for a minute. Half the world really does live on $2 a day or less. But asking God's forgiveness for children starving in Africa is like the political campaigners currently spouting vague platitudes. I'm a candidate for change. I'm in favor of education. Really? Wow. That's very helpful. Just once, I would love to see a campaign ad that said, reading, who needs it? A vote for me is a vote for stupidity. I hope you all agree that that's just a little bit ludicrous. So just for a few moments, let's stop beating ourselves up about the fact that we happen to be born American and some other folks weren't. If you're going to look for problems to solve, let's look a little closer to home. What's the most common problem in this church? People are too busy. I didn't say it's our worst problem. We've got our share of baggage, just like everyone else. But our most common, most visible problem is that we are all horrendously overbooked. We're running ourselves ragged. We feel disconnected from our friends and our families, especially our families. Can I bring you a message from your children? If you gave them a choice between increasing your net worth by $10,000 and having you home more, they would pick you. Unless you're a jerk, and then they take the money. Too many of us are disconnected, stretched thin, dried out, scattered around like a bunch of dry bones. We've all got places in our lives that feel dead, and sooner or later, we are all going to be dead. But we don't talk about that. Wouldn't be polite. We just pretend everything's okay. This is why so many of our young people cut themselves. They know the world is messed up, and they know that they are at least in some way complicit. And they know they're not supposed to talk about it. Especially if that brokenness extends into their own home. Their job is to smile and get good grades so they can get a good job and continue the kind of lifestyle they've grown accustomed to. So they take all those negative feelings and they stuff them until they go numb, until feeling pain feels better than feeling nothing at all. Death and brokenness, that's the inescapable truth of the world we know, the world we live in every day. But our readings claim that death has been overthrown. It is no longer the supreme constant of our world. Ezekiel and John both watch, jaws agape, as God reverses the flow of human events, repeals the second law of thermodynamics, and returns life to that which had lapsed into nothingness. That's the Bible in a nutshell. God created the world, but it became broken and began to fade. Now God is restoring it. God is pulling the scattered bones together, building connections, adding muscle, uniting us into a body. God breathes new life into us. At least, that's the plan. We still have a choice. We can collaborate with it, or we can fight it. Jesus stands at the tomb of Lazarus, orders them to roll the stone away, and calls out in a loud voice, "Lazarus, come forth!" And there's silence. and everyone waits, hoping that it might maybe be true, praying that maybe this time death doesn't win. Silence. So Jesus calls out again, "Lazarus, come forth." Again, silence, which is finally broken by a tiny voice that says, "No, thank you. Nobody here but us dead people. Nothing to see here. Move along. Don't forget to roll the stone back on your way out." The church is not a building. The church is not an institution. The church is you and me transformed into life and light and love. It's not enough that we move with purpose. It's not enough that we come together. God breathes the Spirit into us. And if we will only allow it, that Spirit will transform our lives from the inside out. If we can accept that we are already forgiven, already loved, already alive, then we can stop hiding in tombs and join the celebration. We can watch as God changes our lives and our priorities. Perhaps we can learn to slow down, enjoy our lives, enjoy the young people. Perhaps we will see less war and less poverty. But changes like that only begin here. Between hearts brave enough to be honest and humble enough to be healed. May God make it so in us today.